She was haughty. She was indignant.
Mm-hmm.
She was not terribly interested in children.
Yeah.
As a child, I always felt, I sort of brushed aside. And my children, had the same reaction when they were chronically ill.
Mm.
Children were not anything worth a moment. I don't ever remember that she invited children to have a drink or to. She didn't invite a child to have a conversation with. She would walk around the town, let's face it was only a couple of streets when I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd take cuttings from the garden, and if she was really feeling expansive, she'd pop in for a cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always on her terms,
yeah.
Not yours.
Oh.
She was always elegantly attired, I suppose you could say,
mm.
because she always wore this ankle-length skirts and the high neck with the high collar. And it was quite extraordinary because to have had such remarkably dapper clothing in those days when she lived the way she did.
Mm.
I mean, she didn't always have access to an iron. Mm. So I don't know how she achieved that look, but this was always snowy white.
Mm.
So she was a brilliant laundress, obviously. as I grew older, and I'd always painted from a small child, I'd drawn and painted. I would sit with Albert Namatjira, he had an old white utility which was always having radiator trouble, and when he came into town he'd pull up the appliances, fill up the radiator, and he'd spend hours discussing painting and drawing. But because I was an artist, I was sort of recognised as an artist even as a child. This pink did, as I grew older, encourage me.
Because she was good.
Because she was herself, a watercolourist.
Mm.
And she would collect wildflowers and sketch them and watercolour them. So therefore she was interested in me, to a certain extent, probably more than most of the kids around town.
So when would that have been, roughly what year?
Mm. By about the early 40s.
Oh, I think she was barely a teenager.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in those 1940s years, over the years that she sort of was inclined a little bit to almost even take me under her wing as long as I paid attention.
Mm-hmm.
I had no real beef against her. I just considered her a bit dippy.
Mm.
And I think most of us did, really. She would get everybody's backs up, more the adults than mine.
Mm.
The adults had a bit of a rough ride to hoe with her, because at everything, any conversation, any social interaction had to be on her terms.
Mm.
That's just the way life was.
Right.
Which was very difficult in a very small town.
Yeah.
Small as this one was. And so far away from anywhere else too.
Mm.
Everybody depended on everybody else here. There was no such thing as you couldn't isolate yourself to live in this tiny little community. But sometimes think that Miss Pink wanted to isolate herself. She really didn't have a lot of time for me, wife.
Mm.
That was the impression we had.
Mm.
She would much rather have been with the Aborigines. she was always attending to them. She'd be at the courthouse or down the creek or out on occasional bush trips, even at that time, even after she was living in with the Aborigines. She had talked to me sometimes about her love, the love of her life, the young man who was killed.
Oh, yeah. What did she say?
That she was to have been wed. And that, do you know, I can't really remember now. I think a lot of it went over my head, really. She had letters from him that she'd kept all these years.
He was killed at Gallipoli.
Was he?
Yes. There's a painting of his over at the reserve.
Is there?
A watercolour. Probably would be interested in it.
She had a trunk of memorabilia that was very dear to her. If you were in her good book, she would open it and take out some little mind and show it to you. And
what sort of things did she have in there?
She had some very delicate and beautiful embroidered clothing.
Oh, wow.
Shirts and shirt fronts. Lovely little things. I think they may have been prepared for the wedding. I don't know. And she had them with her. And she always had that trunk with her. Or a picture, or a special little painting, or a photograph from somewhere else.
You never saw her wearing any of the clothes?
No, she wore these very severe black, was it black? It seemed to me, looking back, it always seemed to be black. Or dark navy blue with a sort of a long, looks a deep V front and the white, with a deep V cut down the front of the top. A gourd fitting skirt right down to the ankles. Seems to me, looking back, that it was sort of multi-gourd.
It sort of swept down.
They were gourd, but not full gourds. They were sort of slim gourd. Sort of swept down to the ankles. I suppose it gave her plenty of room for walking. And she herself, of course, was slim and elegant, and her back was so straight and erect. And she always wore a hat. Inside the long V was a lovely white front with a high neckline and a brooch, I think. I can't remember the details. But this was sometimes tucked with sometimes little buttons. Really very elegant, but it was way outdated. I don't think she ever changed her style after he was killed. I had that feeling that she was preserving herself so that he would remember her. I don't know why I had that feeling, but that was. I'm sure that's why she wore what she did, because that black or dark colour, whatever it was, wasn't a good colour for the bush. It showed up everything. And she also wore, I can remember her wearing the button boots. She may have changed her shoes at a later date, but not that I was ever aware of. They had the, you know, the little heel and the little sharp toe. Very well polished. And,
even here?
Very well yes. Very well turned out. And sort of up over the ankle.
Yeah.
And stockings. Never ever barely. And I'd particularly notice that because when she'd sit with you, you know, you'd get the flash of the anchor. It really was another time,
yeah.
and the wrong place.
Yeah. Did you visit her at home?
Yes.
Or, what was the place like?
Space and immaculate.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was very, very neat, very trim, just like she was.
Yeah. Did she ever feed you or give you cups of tea, I think?
A dear cake. She always had the dear cake. Yes. Yeah. And I don't know how she lived, actually. I know people would the town people would always take little bundles or little boxes of food over to her, but she wouldn't accept a gift. So they would just leave it at the door. It was usually after dark or early in the morning. I don't think she really wanted for anything, because the town made sure that, in those days, the town always made sure that if anybody didn't have anything, somebody would give them something. I don't ever think of Miss Pink as being a contributor to the development of Central Australia.
So how would you... what do you think of her as?
A little bit of a hindrance, actually.
Yeah?
Really?
Do you want to pursue that again?
She had never lived in the situation developing a cattle station, developing the land, working and living with the Aborigines the way we were doing it, our families were doing it, sharing. She'd gone out and camped with them in their ambience, if you like. She had never lived in a situation where blacks and whites were living in a sort of developing relationship where we had our house, they had their camp, they preferred their way of living, they used to laugh at us. And we learnt to respect them, because I mean, there were so many things that we could have taken from them socially. For instance, if they had to keep moving their camp because, you know, the food would be eaten out, it would become too dusty and dirty, the water would be gone, they would be, because of the toilet situation itself, it would become unhealthy. So they'd move camp, and they'd move, and that all their life they would move camp, which would keep them clean. If one of them got too old to walk to the next camp, they had no way of transporting them. So they would be given a billy can, a little billy can of water, and some tucker to keep them going for a little while, and they would sing themselves into this dreaming, sort of death dream state. They would accept it, they would know all their life, that was sort of inbred, that when their time came, that's what would happen to them. And they would, you know, and if we tried to interfere in that death chant that they would set up, and we'd sometimes be able to hear it from the homestead, and it would upset us tremendously, but we knew not to interfere, it was nothing we could do. They would die, and then we would have to report it to town, and they would come out and check the whole situation, and then we'd bury them. Meanwhile, the couple would be given a young wife to replace the old wife. They would have a young wife, young husband, an old husband, and an old wife. One would be childbearing, one would be caring for the children, one would be bringing in the food. The whole social structure was a lot better than ours was, really. I mean, we didn't have much to offer them socially when you live with them and grew up with them. My parents had one hard and set rule. We had to speak English in the house. We could speak their language outside, or working with them, or playing with them, or driving with them or whatever, but in the house we had to remember who we were. Never you know, there was never any of this outside the house. It was just, it was just a strict rule right through the bush, I think, that once you set foot inside your home, you remembered that you were a civilised white person. You washed your hands before you sat down to the table, and you didn't come to the table barefoot or you know, without your shirt done up or something. But it was a situation that worked. And the ones that you grew up with around about your own age were, you know, part brothers and sisters. But it was the well-meaning people, I just think, who changed all that, really. So, you know, that was another area in which Spink rules sort of considered her a bit different, because she was considering the Aboriginal situation in another light. No way, in no area of reality that we knew.
Did she get many Aboriginal visitors when she was living in town? Did people come?
Not a lot. You know, if one had problems, that he wouldn't particularly go to her as much as she would find him, or she would involve herself more often than not. The Aborigines have never been dramatically interested in anyone who was a bit off centre, a bit off right. I mean, in those days, the Aborigines considered us fools in many areas. I mean, even little things, for instance, Christmas, and that grandfather Christmas. Why would white people have this strange dream that there was going to be Father Christmas come in the middle of the night and put presents down your chimney? And why was everybody giving everybody presents and saying that came from Father Christmas, when even black fella could tell he didn't exist, you know? And all the Aborigines got presents, you know, they got out of our place when I was a child, they all got California poppy hair oil for the men, because when you rubbed it all over your brown skin, it was wonderful for grobbers and things, you know, you really glistened. And what is it? Oh, plumas. Plumas. So the lubras and the creos, because plumas were wonderful when you were out getting yolka or bush tucker. You put the plumas around your head, the elastic round here. Yeah. They were those old bloomers with the legs and the elastic. And you sort of, that one went round there. And then you tied that one with a bit of grass and that one on the bottom. And you pushed up and everything went in there, and you sort of tied it up, and you had all this weight. It was a properly good one. So the men liked California poppy hair oil, and the women liked plumas for Christmas present. And they all got an enormous feed and Christmas plum pudding and all the rest that everybody else got. You know, they had their Christmas just the same. And that one Jesus, and that one Father Christmas, you know. That. Uh-huh. But I don't know what fella didn't. It was all stupid.
Uh-huh.
What stories are they going to tell us next?
Yeah.
So, you know, they really found anybody who was sort of not like the rest of us was to be pitied. There were a few. I mean, an Aborigine is very agreeable. He will agree with anything. If you told him that sun was purple, say, you are Mrs. And if I said, no, she's wrong, that sun is green, he'd say, you are Mrs. They agree with anything you want them to agree about. I suppose she would have had her friends amongst them, I don't know.
Mm.
But,
she had,
I don't know,
at least one person working for her on the reserve.
Mm.
Johnny Jan Timber.
Right. Mm.
Do you want to just talk about the kids being shot at?
It was the other side of this hill. Yeah, the other side of the back of that.
The Annie Myers Hill now.
Yes, yes. I think by that time she was, you know, getting on. And we were living the other side. And my kids used to sort of come in from the bush, and we had a nice house over there for a townhouse. And there was the swamp out the front and the hill at the side. Well, naturally, I'd spent a lot of time climbing the hill and playing out in the swamp. And they had a horse that an uncle of mine kept in town for them for when they came in. And they just happened to go up the side of the hill one day for usually, and she spotted them. And I still don't know, because she was living the other side of the hill. She must have been up the hill herself. Oh. I don't know. And what she was doing up there with a, I can only think of it as a scatter gun. I don't know.
Mm.
And she took off after them, and they came home in terror. It wasn't very far home. With little bleeding bits in the arms and legs, she fired them. And some of them were so deep that I had to take two of them down to the hospital to have little pellets removed. Mm-hmm. But that was about the same time, that was when she was complaining about the pilots flying low as they got her in the bath. And she must have really been going right off then, I think. You know, she was obviously ill mentally. And that was around about that time, exactly that time actually, the kids were going to leave home. They were going to run away from home. And Scott was a year old.
Huh?
I wouldn't think it to look at him, but he was a big, fat, chubby, happy child. And they loaded up this little red wagon and got all their comics and piled up in the wagon. And then they got Scott, sat him on top of the comics, and then they started off towards the hill. They got down to the corner. I was watching them, of course, so it was tea time. Got down to the corner and they stood there. And then they turned around and came back and they said, "We'll wait until Miss Pink's asleep and we'll have tea first." So they never ever did get round to leaving home. That was it. That must have been just shortly after she took after the pellet gun. I don't know where she got that gun or what she kept it for. She might have had it for birds, because she had started her garden over here. Mm. I think it might have been for birds, actually. It
could have been bird shot.
Could have been, yeah.
You were telling me the story about the when she was driven out and raised the pistol.
Sam Irvine. Yes, that was a well-known story of Sam. Sam was very much a part of everybody's family up here in those days. And he was the first motorised mailman into the outback. And there are many, many stories of Sam, about Sam. But the trip he took her up, I think he took her up to Daly Waters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's where it was, but I seem to remember that it was taking her up to Daly Waters for something.
Mm.
I don't know why she was going up to Daly Waters.
You didn't know when it was?
No, I can't. I can't be terribly sure when it was, but she was. I don't know, but it's a story that's been around for years. So she must. It must have been in her middle years or early middle years. And he made camp, because she didn't travel terribly far in a motor car in those days, in a day. And they didn't have headlights that they could depend on out in the bush. So they first night out, they had tea, and then he rolled out a swag for her one side of the truck. And then he rolled out a swag for himself the other side of the truck. Then he went back to the fire to stoke it up, you know, to more warmth and a bit more light for both of them for the night. And she approached him with a pistol, a little pearl-handled pistol that she found he always carried, and waved at the front of him and said, "Mr. Irvine, I just want you to know this is my protection." He said, "Miss Pink, your place is your protection. You don't need that."
Okay.
It was. I can't imagine that she would have, in normal society, been a very attractive lady, but it was this perpetual sort of haughty scowl that she always wore. Not a scowl as much as this haughty disapproval. It was just the expression that she always wore. I have never, ever seen her laugh or smile. Never. Have you asked anybody else about that?
No.
Did they ever remember Miss Pink laughing?
So she knew, even when she was being nice to you as a young painter, she didn't smile over you?
No. That was all terribly serious. She couldn't have been a very happy lady. She couldn't have had much to be happy about, I suppose. Perhaps she didn't know how to be friendly. Perhaps the reserve was something that she couldn't do about. Looking back now as an older person, of course, I do sort of wonder if, as we know now, that you know, people out there have got problems and they need to be helped. In those days when we were young ones, we were nervous like that. Strange. She must have had a long, unhappy life. And probably she found it easier to relate to the Aborigines and their problems than she did to the white people. I don't know. Perhaps the Aborigines were a social crutch for her, because she could probably get along with them, you know, so distinctly socially on a different level. She might have been able to fight their battles and so feel that she was more socially acceptable. I don't know, just a thought.
It's interesting.
I don't know. It's an analysis that would be difficult to now, all these years after.